Well, good evening. We're continuing on in our Bible study series this evening on the survey of Genesis. And this evening, we are looking at particularly two chapters, chapters 10 and 11. There's a lot packed in to these two chapters. These two chapters are crucial in the sense that they contain the origins of this world's present society. Babylon is the beginning of our civilization. Everything from religion to politics to commerce and finance have their origin at Babylon. And we will see what transpired here. There are some books that have good background information in connection with some of the, with these two chapters. The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop is perhaps one of the most well-known. Chapter 10 focuses in on that and on the Tower of Babel, and chapter 11 goes on. Chapter 10 gets into the sets the stage and has the Table of Nations, and then chapter 11 gets on into the Tower of Babel. One of the things that is necessary here, or one of the keys, is that when the Bible, in Bible prophecy, talks about various nations, it in terms of Bible prophecy, normally these nations are identified under the name of their ancient ancestor. You know, when the Bible talks about the United States, for instance, the words United States aren't in there, but it talks about Israel, it talks about Manasseh, there are references in there. In the same way, other nations, many other nations are referred to in the Bible. Some are easily identified. Take, for example, the nation of Egypt. Now, you read the word Egypt quite a bit in the Old Testament. If you were to do a little research on it, you would find that the word Egypt is actually a Greek term. You know, the names we call nations is not necessarily what those nations call themselves. You know, in this country we speak of Germany and the Germans, but that's not the term that's used there. Deutschland is the term that's used there, and in many other places. For instance, Egypt, throughout the Old Testament, if you were to look it up in a concordance, you would find that everywhere the word Egypt is used in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word is Mitzrayim. And in fact, the national airlines of Egypt to this day is called Al Mitzer. That's the name they use for themselves. That's the name that was used in the Hebrew language. The Greek geographers used the name Egypt, which was derived from one of the names of an ancient king, and that is the name that we're familiar with in the Western world. Even though it's not a name that the Egyptians used for themselves, that historically it's not the name they call themselves in Arabic or in Hebrew. And anywhere in the Old Testament you read the word Egypt, actually, if you check it up in concordance, it's the word Mitzrayim. Well, when you go through Genesis 10, you find Mitzrayim. You find him listed, and you know that is the term. The word Ethiopia, for instance, anywhere you read in the Old Testament and you read the word Ethiopia, again, Ethiopia was a term that the Greek geographers used, and was not the name that anciently that those people called themselves. If you take a concordance, just look up the word Ethiopia in the Old Testament and go back and find out. You'll find anywhere in the Old Testament it's used, the Hebrew word is Cush, C-U-S-H. So, you know, you go through Genesis 10, well, you find Cush. And that is the Cushites were the people of Ethiopia. And there are some names that are very clear that way. Other ways in which, you know, how do we identify some of these the Table of Nations? And I would just say in terms of the Table of Nations that I think the general outline that I have contained there is correct. There may be some of the small groupings that, you know, sometimes it's not as totally clear cut. Sometimes you have two or three tribes that inhabit a modern day nation state, and so it's not always just totally cut and dried. But what we find is that in some cases, some nations are clearly identified just in terms of Old Testament usage. They use the name of their ancient forebearer on down for quite a number of centuries, and that's the name by which they were anciently referred to in Hebrew and the terms to this day. In other cases, there were, there was a change of languages and names, pronunciations of names, spelling of names. These things have altered over the years. You have to realize our spellings here are in English. These words were written in Hebrew, which used a different alphabet. You sound out, if you go from one alphabet to another, then there's often more than one way you can spell a word. You sound it out, and you try to reproduce the sound in your own language using your own alphabet. So there, different languages actually even use certain different sounds. You know, there's a range of sounds. There's sounds that we don't use in English. If you learn a language that uses those sounds, and particularly if you're an adult, you may have a lot of trouble with it because those sounds you never learn to make as a little child. And that's why, so all of these things make for where there can be sometimes some confusion on the matter. The ancient historians, particularly the Arabic historians, because Arabic is similar to Hebrew, and the Arabs have inhabited that general area over in Arabia and in the Middle East from antiquity. And so in many cases, there are Arab historians who will record names that are sort of intermediate names between what's used in the scriptures, or they will use the name that is used in Hebrew and in Arabic and then will identify it with a certain name that was in common use by the Greeks. The Romans took most of their geographic knowledge from our geographic names from the Greeks. You had a couple of famous Greek historians and geographers that were responsible for the way a lot of names have come down to us. So all of these things enter in, and we will look more directly at some of it as we go along. Now, Genesis chapter 10, verse 1 says, "Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And unto them were sons born after the flood." And then we began to have a name, the names of sons that were given. Now, we don't have the names of all of the children that Shem, Ham, and Japheth had. Obviously, they had wouldn't have done them any good to have had a bunch of sons if there weren't any daughters born to anybody. Things would have stopped a long time ago. So what we have listed here as sons are clearly the sons that gave rise to major tribal groupings. And there may have been even other sons that were born who in turn only had daughters and did not give rise to a separate, a separate grouping. But one factor that comes in, sometimes people look and they say, well, how could you have had, how could the population have grown to any size within a relatively short period of time? Because as we will see in just a few minutes, that from the time of the flood until the Tower of Babel was just over 100 years. Now, clearly you had enough people to gather together in there at Babel. What would the population have been? Well, we don't know exactly, but we know a couple of things. One, the lifespans were quite lengthy. that you find, you know, the ones that are listed, Noah, Shem. It doesn't give the length of life of Ham and Japheth, but we're told that Arphaxad was 100 years old, and this is in Genesis 11, verse 10. He was 100 years old and begat Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. Well, evidently, he was 98 when the at the time of the flood, and 2 years later, Arphaxad was born, and Shem was 100. And he lived after he begat Arphaxad 500 years and begat sons and daughters. How many sons and daughters did he have? Well, you know, we don't know. But if you had large families, and again, realize they had the whole earth out there, there was plenty of room to spread out, plenty of room as for crops to be grown, livestock to reproduce, the things that would tend to cut down the population were not factors, certainly in those times immediately after the flood. And if you just look at let's start off. Let's say that each let's use a round figure. It can vary, but let's say each of them gave rise to 10 family units. Now, that's not you know, by any means unheard of. God told them to be fruitful and multiply. You go back even to the, you know, the pioneer period of this country, and large families, even, you know, 12, 15 kids and more, was not uncommon. They had a much longer period of let's say, reproductive life. So to say that each one gave rise to 10 families, 10 family units, is not, I don't think, some great stretch. Well, just think of it. Here, right after the flood, children began to be born. There were three of them. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So that would, let's say, the second generation. That's the first generation of the flood. We come on down, and the second generation, that would be, let's say, 30 families now. So we're down maybe 30 years after the flood, and now you've got, 30 families. Well, of each of those, see, the next generation would be 300. And the next one would be 3,000. The next one would be 30,000. I mean, all of a sudden, it obviously didn't go on like that interminably, but it would not take very many generations to where you could certainly be talking about, by the time of the Tower of Babel, 10, 15,000 people. And within, a couple of generations after then, you realize, you know, if you had 15,000 population something like that, and you increase tenfold, all of a sudden you're looking at 150,000. Then you're looking at 1.5 million. Now, it obviously didn't keep up with that generation after generation. The point is that you don't have to get very many generations down as people are beginning to spread out over a huge, vast, and habitable earth where they've got plenty of place to get between them and their neighbors. There's the livestock would have, the animals would have reproduced very quickly because, again, there's so much out there, so much vegetation and everything to support them, that you don't have to get very far down from the flood before the population could be, up at levels that become very much what we find in ancient times, because we know as far as the experts as well as they can determine the population of the whole earth back, for instance, at the time of Christ was probably no more than maybe 100 million or so. That's the estimates that they generally use. And I don't know that they can prove that, but there are census figures for the Roman Empire. There are census figures for China and some major areas that they can use as sort of a comparison. So The point is that the population in the ancient world during Old Testament period was not really that great. I mean, the entire population of the world, as we come on down through that period, would have been measured only in tens of millions. And you wouldn't have had to have gone very many generations after the flood before you began to get those figures. So as we begin to look at the story, this just sort of gives an estimate. We don't obviously know the exact growth, but we do know sort of the general story that's recorded here. We find that Japheth had several sons and records some of those and some of his grandsons, doesn't record all of them. And we're told in verse 5, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, after their families and their nations. You see, so God, the families of the human family began to multiply and to spread out. Then we go to the sons of Ham, Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. Can clearly, of course, identify Cush and Mitzrayim because those names were used throughout the Old Testament period and were used by the nations that sprang from them. And they have actually come down as identifiable modern nations. There were others, of course, that sprang from them. It goes into this. And in verse 8, we're told that Cush begat Nimrod. Nimrod began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Eternal. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, and the land of Shinar. Now Nimrod, this term mighty one in the Hebrew, it's one word in the Hebrew, it's the Hebrew word gibor, G-I-B-B-O-R, we would spell it in English. It means literally a tyrant or a despot. Nimrod began to be a mighty one. He began to be a tyrant, a despot. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, realize after the flood, what begins to happen? Well, the animals began to reproduce very quickly. There is a there's a big earth to fill. It's not long before the predators began to, they began to multiply pretty rapidly. Wolves and wild animals such as that. The term refers to the mighty hunter here is Nimrod evidently set himself up early on as a protector of humanity. You know, all of the tyrants and the despots down through the centuries have always tried to portray themselves as the saviors, the protectors. I mean, Hitler did that, Mussolini did that, Napoleon did that. All of the great, all of the tyrants and the despots, none of them ever said, look, I want to be in office so I can really crush you people down and take advantage of you. Well, no, they generally come to power promising deliverance, promising help. Nimrod evidently was a mighty hunter. He was one in mythology. He is identified as the hunter of wolves. In fact, the ancient Roman holiday that is called in our modern times by Valentine's Day. You know, there was a holiday in Rome at exactly the same period right there, 14th of February, that involved the sending of hearts and all of that, that the Romans called Lupercalia. And it was celebrated in honor of Lupercus, who was the comes from the Latin term that refers to wolf. He was the hunter of wolves. He was the slayer of wolves. And there are various things that point back. Nimrod initially presented himself as a mighty hunter. He was the protector. Evidently came up with the idea, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Now, as we come on down through the story, and as we get into Genesis 11, we'll find a little bit about the building of Babel. But that was the starting point of Nimrod's kingdom. Well, perhaps he said, well, look, we need to build some fortifications. We need to build a wall here. And most of the human family Nimrod gathered together. You know, they came down out of the mountains. Noah and his family came down out of the mountains of Armenia after the flood, and they settled there in the plain in the land of Shinar, which we're told in Genesis 11, the first couple of verses. Now, that is the area there, the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. They came down out of this high mountainous region right after the flood, came down into the plains, very fertile area, and they had the whole place out before them, and the family began to increase. Now, it was God's intent and purpose that, and He had undoubtedly instructed them through Noah, that as the families got to a certain size, they were to spread out and to recolonize the earth. You know, God allocated out the earth to the various branches of the human family. In fact, He had told Noah that that his family was to spread out. His family was to overspread the whole earth. We're told in Genesis 9 and verse 19 that God instructed them that what they were to what they were to do. He told Noah in Genesis 9 verse 1. God blessed Noah and his sons. He said unto them, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth. So it was God's intent that they spread out, that they colonized, recolonized the earth. Nimrod evidently, we see that there was a rebellion against God here at Babel. Nimrod evidently instigated it. He was the leader. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel. He was a mighty hunter, and he was a mighty one. He was a tyrant, a despot. And perhaps he persuaded people, you know, that, oh, no, you don't want to spread out. You don't want to go all these areas. Something might happen to you. We better all stay together right here. And so they built a city, and then they built this tower that they viewed as going to be a means of protection. They wanted to build a tower. End of verse 4, Genesis 11, end of verse 4, it says, let us make a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Now, that had been God's intent, that they spread out over the whole earth. They said, we don't want to spread out over the whole earth. You know, isn't it amazing? Whatever God tells people, but God has ways of getting people to do what He wants. You know, it was God's intent that our nations be overspread. Can you imagine if, back in the early days of the history of this country, if God had sent a prophet and told people on the East Coast, look, I want you to spread out over the country and go all the way to the Pacific. Oh, no. You know why? There's desert out there, and there's Indians, and there's rattlesnakes, and, you know, we'll get killed if we try to do that. God didn't do that. He just made sure that the gold was in California, on the West Coast. All they had to do was yell gold, and people like to broke their neck getting from one coast to the next. Worked real well. You find the same thing down in Australia. You know, the gold was on the opposite side of the continent from where the people were. So immediately people began to overspread the continent. So you find the gold in the remote areas, and people break their neck trying to get there. So God has ways of getting people to go where He wants them to go. You know, He could ensure the Middle East was going to be the center all of the great geopolitical conflict in this time period, the end of the 20th century. Just make sure that the largest portion of the world's petroleum reserves are right there under the sand in the Middle East. that will give plenty of incentive that people will be fighting about it as long as it's there. You know, if there was nothing there, they're not fighting over the Sahara Desert. But, you know, God had ways. He just ensured that the resources were at the proper place, and that would ensure that people wound up and did the things that they needed to do. So anyway, as we come on down here in Genesis chapter 10, we find that Nimrod was the instigator of Babel, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh and the land of Shinar. And out of that land went forth Asher and builded Nineveh, the city of Reboth and Calneh. And it talks about these places that were built, some of which in the aftermath of the Tower of Babel. Human population was undoubtedly growing very rapidly at that point in time, beginning to explode out as things were probably upwards of several thousand, maybe 5,000-10,000 people around the time of the Tower of Babel. And then by the time of the next generation, then it really began to multiply out within the next 50-60 years, during which some of these things were taking place in the beginning of kingdoms and all of the many of which started little city states. You know, in some cases you're talking, when we think of a city, we think of, Dallas. Well, they weren't, when it's talking about these places, not talking about something like Dallas. It's talking about what we would think of more as like a little small fort or something, a little fortified area where people could come in and would be protected by walls from either other people or the wild animals. And so many of these little fortified areas initially may have had populations of even a few hundred. Perhaps Babel initially had a greater population. Things were growing rapidly. But we find here the beginnings of what Nimrod did in his attempt to gain power over the human race. Now, what is one of the things that has always been used by people, by any sort of tyrant who wanted to control the people? Well, religion has always played a big role. You know, in the Roman Empire, they worshiped the emperor. In various empires, various kingdoms, there was always something that focused the people on their ruler, and that served as some sort of source of unity. That was the idea. When you look at the religious ideas that have spread out around the world, you find certain things, even certain symbols that run through and are common to people as diverse as all the way from, Aztec over in Central America, all the way across to peoples in the Middle East, peoples in the Far East. You find certain symbols, certain ideas, certain themes that have run through. Well, there's a reason for that, because ultimately these people all spread out from Babel, and many of them took various twists that were given. One of the things that you find when you go through some of the reference books, such as Hyslop's Two Babylons, is the fact that many of our holidays that people take for granted as being just common, days that everybody celebrates, Christmas and Easter and Valentine's Day and various things of that sort. You track back and you find that many of these festivals and the symbols attached to them go all the way back to ancient Babylon. They go back to Babylon. They go back to Egypt. And so this is the reason for it. Well, it describes goes through the the various ones, the descendants here of Ham, coming on through the on down through the Canaanites. And it says in verse 20, these are the sons of Ham after their families, after their tongues, in their countries, and in their nations. And unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber. Now, Eber, the term Hebrew is derived from Eber. So technically, all the descendants of Eber would have been, initially would have been considered Hebrews. Hebrew is derived from this. Well, Shem was the father of the children of Eber. He was the brother of Japheth the elder. Shem is normally listed first because of prominence, but evidently Japheth was the elder brother, then Ham, who's always listed middle, and Shem was actually the younger, or the youngest son, though normally he's listed first because of his prominence. Now, we get into more detail about Shem here, that he had children. And it lists them, Elam and Asher and Arphaxad and Lud and Aram. And it goes through and begins to trace the that Shem had a son by the name of Arphaxad. And Arphaxad had Salah, verse 24, and Salah had Eber. So Eber was the grandson of Arphaxad, the great-grandson of Shem. And he's the one from whom the term Hebrew comes. Now, unto him were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Now, we're told in verse 31, these are the sons of Shem after their families, after their tongues and their lands. And these are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations and their nations, and by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood. Now, here we read of Peleg, and we're told that in his days was the earth divided. Now, how was the earth divided? Well, the very next chapter and verse tells us the whole earth was of one language and one speech. It was united, and it became divided. God said in verse 6 of Genesis 11, the people is one. They have one language. And so, verse 7, let's go down and confound their language. And the Lord scattered them abroad. Verse 8, from thence upon the face of all the earth. So, here we have the dividing of the nations. Peleg was named, his name meant division. So he was evidently born at the time when things began to divide out, the events of the Tower of Babel. Now, how long after the flood was Peleg born? This is the way we derive how long after the flood did the Tower of Babel occur. Well, we're told in Genesis 11, verse 10, that Arphaxad was born 2 years after the flood. And we're told down in verse 12 that Arphaxad lived to be when he lived 35 years, he begat Salah. Okay, 2 years after the flood plus 35 years to the birth of Salah, that is 37 years. And then Salah, verse 14, lived 30 years and begat Eber. So we've come down 37 years, now we've come another 30. That brings us to 67 years. And Eber lived 34 years, verse 16, begat Peleg. So 67 plus 34 brings you to 101. And on that basis, we would conclude Peleg was born 101 years after the flood, and in his days was the earth divided. So he was evidently born at the time of the events described here, of the confusion of the languages at the Tower of Babel. And that began to occur. So we're just a little over 100 years after the flood. Now, Genesis chapter 11 gives us a genealogy that allows us to put together the chronology of the Bible. There are certain events that enable us to put these things together. Otherwise, we would not be able to hang a time frame on events. the genealogies give us a basis of that. If you want to follow on down, Peleg was born, we found, 101 years after the flood. Now, verse 18, Peleg lived 30 years and had a son by the name of Reu. So that brings us down to 131 years after the flood. And then verse 20, Reu lived 32 years and had a son, Serug. Now, 32 and 131, that brings us to 163 years when Serug was born. Serug, verse 22, lived 30 years and begat Nahor. Well, 163 plus 30 brings you down to 193 years. And Nahor lived 29 years and begat Terah. That's 193 plus 29. That would be what? 222, wouldn't it? Somebody's keeping up with my math here. That'd be 222 years till the birth of Terah, who was Abraham's father. Now, as we come on down from the, if you just read verse 26, Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran, you'd think that these must have all been triplets. Well, as you put the story together, they clearly weren't, because we're told in verse 27 that Terah begat Abraham, or Abram. Describes a little bit of background of the family. And we find that Terah, verse 31, took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, and they went forth out of Ur of the Chaldees, and they came to the land of Haran, came to the city of Haran. And Terah died at age 205. He died at age 205, verse 32. He died in Haran. And now we saw that he was born 222 years after the flood, and if he lived to be 205, that's 222 plus 205, that would bring us to 427 years after the flood, would be the death of Terah. Now, what's the significance of the year of his death? Well, it's not apparent just if you just look at it, take a surface look, but let's look. He died at age 205, verse 32. He died in Haran. Continuing right on the very next verse of the next chapter, Genesis 12:1. Now the Lord said unto Abram, get you out of your country, from your kindred, from your father's house, unto a land that I will show you. Verse 4, so Abram departed. Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. Now, he didn't depart out of Haran until his father was dead. And he was 75 when he departed. If you go back to Acts chapter 7, some of this is brought out where we're told... In Acts 7:2, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran. Said, get out of this your country from your kindred. He came out of the land of the Chaldeans, dwelt in Haran. From thence, when his father was dead, he removed him into this land. Abram didn't leave until his father was dead. He was 75, and his father was 205. Well, if Terah was 205 when Abraham left, and he was 75, that means Terah was 130 when Abraham was born. So Terah began having children. These three sons aren't mentioned until he was 70, and he was 130 when Abraham was born. So, as I say, the estimates I gave you of population are very... very, very conservative estimates, because we're looking at people whose reproductive life stretched over a century. I mean, if the men lived that long, you would figure the women lived comparable periods. So I think the clear implication is we're looking at large families by any stretch of the imagination. And the point is that within 427 years after the from the end of the flood until Abraham left that area, and sometimes we don't put these things together, but Shem lived 500 years after the flood. Actually 502 years. He begat Arphaxad 2 years after the flood and lived 500 years after that. This is Genesis 11, verses 10 and 11. So, when Abraham left at age 75, could Abraham have heard a first-person account of the flood in the pre-flood world? Sure he could have. His ancestor Shem was still alive. Shem's lifespan stretched down to the time of Abraham and until Abraham was pretty old. Shem lived almost to the end of, not quite to the end of Abraham's life, but they overlapped for quite a number of years. And that's one of the ways in which knowledge was passed on, in which some of these things were passed on. There may very well have even been documents that were on board the ark, documents that Noah would have, would have had, that would have been preserved on the ark. You think about it, that Noah's grandfather was Methuselah. Methuselah lived all the way down until the year of the flood. So Methuselah overlapped Noah's life by 600 years. Methuselah overlapped Adam's life by at least a couple of hundred years. You realize in just a matter of going through about three or four mouths in terms of the story of some of these things. We're not looking at things that, there was a lot closer connection in that regard. Now, what we find is that the whole human family very quickly got off into idolatry. And that's apparent because when we go to the book of Joshua, I can just call your attention to something. Back in here in Joshua 24, Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel together to Shechem. This is Joshua 24:1. And verse 2, Joshua said unto all the people, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, your fathers dwelt on the other side of the flood." The term here is the river, and some of your modern translations will bring it out that way. It was a reference to the Euphrates. Your forefathers lived beyond the Euphrates in old time. Even Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Nahor. And they served other gods. And I took your father Abraham from the other side of the flood, the other side of the Euphrates, the other side of the river, and led him throughout all the land of Canaan and multiplied his seed and gave him Isaac. The family of Abraham had even lapsed into idolatry. And you find that as you go on down into the book of Genesis. We remember when Jacob went back to the family, back to his mother's brother, to Laban. And you find that Laban had all sorts of little idols around. That is referred to back here in Genesis chapter in Genesis 30 and 31, that when Laban came and let's see, we'll pick it up down here, Genesis chapter 31, and verse 30. Laban is telling Jacob. He says, "Now, though you would need be gone, because you soar long after your father's house, yet wherefore have you stolen my gods?" Laban had all these little idols around. Laban, of course, was a kinsman. Joshua tells us that Abraham's family was worshiping idols. So what we find is that, you know, right after the flood, as Nimrod sought to get the whole human family together, idolatrous religion had its beginnings. Now you wonder, how can people get so far off the track so quickly? Well, how long does it take people to get off the track and to go, you know, to lose the truth and go into idolatry? It doesn't take very long. So why should we be amazed? It's happened over and over. It happened within, a relatively short time. Within 100 years after the flood, false religion was being introduced. And, some of it was coming down. We see that a lot of this originated in the family of Ham through Cush and Nimrod, and very likely there were legends and stories from the pre-flood world, from the false religion there that came down, that was preserved through and some of the wives of Noah's sons, and perhaps maybe Ham himself and others, that some of these stories that they told and would have picked up on a lot of the myths and legends that had been a part of pre-flood religion, pre-flood world, and it was adapted and given a twist. That's why we find a certain continuity that comes through from the pre-flood world to the present age. And we see that false religion, Babylon and Egypt were the centers of that. We know that Nimrod began in Babylon, and the whole human family was there. As we look at the genealogy preserved in Genesis 10, we recognize that Nimrod and his family, at the time when they left Babylon, must have gone down to Africa, to Egypt, from whence African population and culture spread on out from there, because we find the family of Cush and some of the other, Cush's brother Mitzrayim and others right there in that area and going on beyond it. So we shouldn't be surprised when we find a strong correlation between Babylon and Egypt in terms of their religion, and we find that that represents the basis, the kind of religion that spread on through. The Greeks, the Romans got their religion from the Greeks, and the Greeks got it from Egypt. And the Greeks even acknowledge that they got it from Egypt and tell the story in their mythology of how, in their history, of how a lot of their religion came out of Egypt. And so we find these same things that spread out. Well, within a matter of time, we find there's a corrupting influence. And so the family of, here even descendants of Shem that came on down to the family line that gave rise to Abraham, they began to get involved in that. And we find that we're not told that all the details, but Abraham left Ur of the Chaldees. There were, in Genesis 11:27, these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. He had three sons. Haran begat Lot, and Haran died before his father, Terah, in the land of his nativity, in Ur of the Chaldees. And so Haran died, but he had a son by the name of Lot, and Abraham took Lot, his nephew, because Haran had been his older brother, and Lot was his nephew, and Haran died there in the land of their nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. Now, we don't know the circumstances of his death, but we're told that Abram and Nahor took wives. And Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. And Sarah was barren. Well, in verse 31, Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's sons. Lot was his grandson. Sarah, his daughter-in-law. And they went forth from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. They came to Haran and dwelt there. And we don't know how long they spent in Haran. They left Ur of the Chaldees. Now, if you look at most Bible atlases, they will. There were two Urs, two cities of Ur in ancient times. One was up in the northern Euphrates area, which is where Haran is, up in the northern Euphrates. The other Ur was down in the southern Euphrates Valley, down near Babylon. Many of the commentators will identify the Ur of Abraham as being the northern Ur, the one up near Haran. I think as you read the story, it's clear that it had to have been the southern Ur because it's specifically called Ur of the Chaldees. Now, Chaldea was another name for Babylon, and the Chaldeans were the Babylonians. And they were in the southern part. And I think clearly the area where Abraham was born was in the vicinity of Babylon. And he left that. Much of his, we're given the indication that his family by this time had pretty well all lapsed into idolatry. And Abram was told to leave. And they journeyed up the Euphrates River up to Haran, and his father had gone with him, and his father died there. We don't know exactly how long they spent in Haran, but Abraham left Haran when his father died, and he was 75, and came on to the land of Canaan. Abraham was aware of some of the problems that existed in his family. That was one of the reasons he insisted that Isaac not be taken back, or Isaac not go back to that area. Abraham knew some of the problems. You know, Jacob did go back, and if it hadn't been for God's mercy, he'd have never gotten loose. So Abraham knew, you know, that they needed to sort of keep their distance from some of that bunch. So they did. They moved down to an area. Sometimes, you know, in order to obey God, we need sort of a fresh start. And that's what Abraham needed. We find here the connection of Abraham and Lot. We'll get into that in the next Bible study. Now let's go back up here to Genesis 11, the earlier part, and we look at the Tower of Babel. The land of Shinar, which is this area of Babel, of Babylon, that it had a number of advantages. It was a very fertile area, and they used brick, made brick there. It had there was a lot of clay where you could make brick, so they used brick as their building material in place of stone because of where they were, and they used mortar. And they said, "Let's build us a city and a tower. We want to make a name. We don't want to be scattered abroad." Verse 5 of Genesis 11, "The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men built. And the Lord said, Behold, the people is one. They have all one language. This they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do." You know, it's amazing how much the human race can get done when the talents and abilities of the whole human race, of all the different branches of the human family, are all pooled and put together. Much of the progress of the 20th century has been because people have been able to communicate, you find that knowledge is built in a cumulative fashion. Well, the problem is not working together. The problem is, are you working together to do good or evil? You know, being efficient is wonderful if what you're doing is good. It's terrible if what you're doing is bad. You know, Hitler was efficient. But what did he, you know, what was he efficient in doing? It's, you know, the human family all working together. All people say, well, that's good. Well, it's not good if what they're doing isn't good. If they're doing evil things, if they're pursuing things that are going to be destructive. So God, in effect, ensured slowing down human progress. You know, when he confused the languages, that didn't mean every single person spoke a different language. It meant the different groups, different families spoke different languages. And they were therefore unable to work together. Now at this point, after that happened, now they were finally willing to follow the instructions that undoubtedly they had been given through Noah earlier, and that was to spread out and to go in some of these various directions. Now the languages that they were given were primary languages. God, we're not told exactly what all languages were given, but you know, take English, for instance. Well, English as we know it, if you go back more than about 400 years, you go back prior to the time of Shakespeare and the King James Bible, you began to run into problems trying to understand it or read it. You go back to the time of Chaucer, and unless you've had special training, you couldn't make heads or tails of it. You go back a little earlier than that, maybe back to the time of Beowulf, and you might as well be reading Norwegian or something. We can trace in historical times, let's say in the last 2,000 years for which we have record, we can trace many of the languages of Europe back to certain languages, let's say the Romance languages of French and Italian and Spanish and Portuguese. You don't have to. It's a matter within historical times. They were speaking Latin in all those areas. Those are outgrowths of the Latin language. Same thing, the Germanic language. When you go back to even the different German dialects and the Scandinavian languages and Dutch and Anglo-Saxon, a lot of these languages have really only diverged out in the last 2,000 years. Scandinavians and the English and some of those spoke the language of their captors. That was why those languages diverged out. People who go into captivity wind up losing their language. Maybe a word or a name here or there will be retained, but people who go into a captivity and are taken to another area, they lose the language. They take on, within a couple of generations, they've pretty well lost the language, and they've taken on the language of their other captors. And so some of these things have happened, and there is a natural development that as people are isolated from one another, language alters and changes. That we see that even in different parts of the English speaking world. You can look at other languages, where the language diversifies out. I know down in South Louisiana, the French that was spoken, people from South Louisiana who went to France had trouble being understood, because the French that was spoken in France was from the dialect, it was Parisian French. It was from that dialect. Well, you go back several hundred years ago, the ancestors of the people in South Louisiana, when they left Normandy and Brittany up on the coast, came to Canada and then down to South Louisiana. Well, they left way back in the 1600s. They spoke a totally different dialect of French. And so the years have gone by, and unless people have stayed in contact or reading the same books and things like that, the language continues to diversify out, and there were different dialects to begin with. So some of those things would have happened, but God sped up the process because it wouldn't have happened quickly enough, and it was His purpose that the human family, within about a century after the flood, that the families had grown large enough that they could begin the process of migration out, and they began to go into the various areas that God had as their inheritance. We find that inevitably people have been deluded by Satan into resist what God wants. What God desires for us is always what's really for the best. So God says, let's go down, confound their language that they won't understand. The Lord, verse 8, Genesis 11, scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the languages of all the earth. And from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. Now that, of course, is why, as you look at the myths and the legends of various peoples, whether you're looking at Egypt or in Babylon or in Persia or in China, in portions of Africa, in many areas, you find that there are certain common myths that go through. Things, you know, you find the worship of the sun god and much of the symbolism attached with that that you find running through virtually all of the pagan religions. You find some of the symbols being the same, you know, come all the way down. And there's a reason for that, because it stemmed from the same source. And it is an interesting and fascinating study when you go back and you look at some of the holidays and you look at some of these things. God uses Babel as the type of the end time system. You see, God's going to build one world, but it's going to be one world based on His law. Satan has attempted to build one world, but it's one world in rebellion against God. What you find is the story beginning in Genesis. We start with Babel, the city that Nimrod built. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel. We come all the way down from the beginning of Genesis all the way back to the end of the book of Revelation. And you read about Babylon the Great. That was the fountainhead of this world civilization. Religion flowed out from Babylon, and the whole political structure that began at the Tower of Babel. What we are going to find, what we are finding in over the course of the next few years, is the attempt to, in effect, to revive Babylon once again. To recreate that system, you see. One political system, one military, one economic, one religion, one system. Did you see, by the way, that the Pope issued an apostolic letter today that came out on the sanctity of saints? And this has begun to... there was an interesting article in the Dallas paper, on the Sunday paper, on the subject. And, you know, it will be interesting to see so how this develops. You know, first you have to plant the seed before the plant grows and matures and yields its fruit. And we see a number of things, you know, just in isolated areas. But ultimately, it all goes back to Babylon. And it is remarkable in which, as you look at the story and you see how man's system has spread out. Of course, as we go through and study even the migrations of peoples, you find that here were people migrating out from that area, coming out and coming in and settling areas that much of the world has, you know, there have been large population shifts and large population movements going back, and even in the time, let's say, since the time of Christ, much of Europe and there are many areas of the world that have taken on their present configuration. So the whole situation got started way back then. And now with Genesis 12, we come down to Abraham. We're introduced to Abraham. And what we find is that for the rest of the Bible is focused in on the family of Abraham and where God was working. And other nations are addressed to the extent that they came in contact, because the rest of the book of Genesis follows the story of Abraham's family and brings them down to Egypt. And you see, the story focuses in on where God was working, where His Word was being revealed and being preserved, the family that gave rise to the Messiah, that gave rise to the Bible. And so up until now, the book of Genesis, Genesis 10 and 11, gives us a background to understand where the whole human family came from. But then God very quickly narrows the focus down where He is working to reveal and to maintain and preserve His truth. And God has ensured the preservation of His truth from antiquity. And that is sort of the background of the story that we're given right here in Genesis 10 and 11. We'll get the next Bible study. We will begin to pick up the story. We get more into the narrative account, and we'll pick it up in chapter 12 and go on from there. And in just a matter of a few moments, we'll pass out questions for next time. Does anybody have any questions relating to the material that we covered here this evening in terms of Genesis 10 and 11? We've got just a couple of minutes. Anybody have any other just general Bible questions, or we'll open it up for that right now if somebody's got something.
Okay.
Oh, he did.
Yeah. And apparently the general of the nation went to Moscow to Gorbachev and made meetings with him to establish an Olympian state combination for world peace. There are big meetings there. Maybe this is a result of that, but the rest of them just have to create work.
It's interesting. You know, the stage is being set, I think, in so many ways, and you realize that it's only a strong man arises in a time of turmoil. It arises when people begin to get scared. Something has to happen. You know, when people are prosperous and everything's going well, they don't want somebody bossing them around telling them what to do. But when they get scared, and when, you know, it seems like everything's on the verge of collapse, then they're willing to accept some strong man. So I think in a lot of ways, the stage is being set, the framework begins to be constructed, and people don't know what is going to happen as the thing begins to get fleshed out. But I think it's going to be very interesting, the things that it seems that this Pope has a little bit of unfinished business left to tend to, and he appears to be actively trying to tend to it. That's interesting. Yeah.
You know when Moses, we're jumping forward a little bit here.
Okay.
But when his son, around the circumcision of his son, it's got that little blip where it says that God.
Yeah, we're going to be covering that in about two Bible studies. If I answer all of that now, you won't need to come back and hear the Bible study. Okay, let's. I've got. Let's see. No. Pardon? Says that about Moses. We're going to cover Genesis 12 through 36 next Bible study.